the home of Bob and Ray.
Beautifully spoken.
Very nicely done. Thank you, Roger. And hello again, everybody. 4:15. And we greet you from the big W-shaped desk. Bob over there and Ray over here. We'll be with you now until 7 o'clock tonight.
Sounds like we've got a couple of good days coming up. Weather-wise, it's going to get warmer tomorrow and the next day. And it's going to be very pleasant here today because we have all kinds of guests and features and just a fun-packed 3 hours. I think, first of all, in keeping with the Bob and Ray fairness doctrine, we ought to present our guest here to present a rebuttal to a recent BNR editorial. Okay. And he is Mr. Willis Mumford. And I believe you're here to talk about an editorial we did saying that highly organized sports for young children may be a bad thing. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
All right. Willis Mumford, you're the center fielder for the 49th Street Tigers in Secaucus. Go right ahead. You can start the statement now.
All right, Bob and Ray. I've got it all written down here.
I think you better stand in front of this microphone over here, Willis. Nobody can hear you from over there in the corner.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that's how it worked.
Yeah, right over here.
Oh.
Go ahead.
I said I've got it all written down here, so I'll just read it off the way I've gotten it written down here. Is that okay?
That sounds fine. Just don't be nervous and go right ahead, son.
All right, I'll try hard. My fellow sports fans, recently Bob and Ray broadcast an editorial that spoke out strongly against children. They said kids are especially bad for organized sports like baseball. In response...
Well, wait a minute, Willis. I don't want to make you nervous by interrupting, but our editorial didn't speak out against children or say that you were bad for sports. It was the other way around. We said that organized sports might be bad for you.
No, that's not what you said. And I've got the things you said all written down here so I can really rake you over the coals in my response.
Well, I was looking at that statement you have there. It doesn't seem to be in a child's handwriting. Did you really prepare that yourself?
Well, no, not exactly. My coach, Moose Harrigan, helped me with it. But he didn't want to come down here and read it himself because he's got an awful temper. Right now he's so mad at you guys he could spit.
And so you volunteered to speak for the coach and the rest of the team, right?
Yeah, that's right. Moose Harrigan said that if I didn't, he'd make me sit on the bench until the splinters grew right up to the seat of my pants.
Well, Willis, these editorial rebuttals are only supposed to be made by responsible individuals with opposing views to our own.
Oh, I'm a responsible individual, Bob and Ray. I got a paper route and everything like that. Besides, there's not much more to this statement. It's just that it says that you people are beneath contempt for speaking out against the children of America.
Uh-huh.
And then it calls upon your listeners to drag you out of here and horsewhip you.
Uh-huh.
And then it closes with some words I don't understand. Most of them have only four letters in them, but I don't know what they mean.
Yeah, well, I think it's best you just skip that part of it then, and thank you, and I guess you better run along back to see Caucus now.
I'd really rather stick around here until things cool off, Bob and Ray. Moose Harrigan said I'd better pull this off just right or he'd fix my wagon good. There was even a passing mention that I might vanish from center field and never be seen again.
Oh, I don't think you'd try anything now that you've told the world about this threat against your life. Let me close by saying this has been a rebuttal to Bob and Ray editorial. Speaking on behalf of organized competitive sports for your children has been Willis Mumford of the 49th Street Tigers, Secaucus, New Jersey.
This editorial rebuttal has been produced under the auspices of the Bob and Ray Public Affairs Department. The views expressed are not necessarily those of this station or its employees, or even of Willis Mumford, who expressed them. However, they do seem to be the views of Moose Harrigan.
Transcript of this editorial rebuttal may be obtained by sending a stamped self-addressed envelope to Bob and Ray International Headquarters, and we'd suggest that you save yourself the trouble and don't write in. Thank you.
Mary Backstage, Noble Wife, the story of America's favorite family of the footlights and of their fight for security and happiness against the concrete heart of Broadway. Although Harry, Calvin, Pop, and Greg haven't heard from Mary, rehearsals for their appearance in La Traviata began yesterday at La Scala. Now it's later the same day, and in the backstage suite at the Hotel Raphael, our friends discuss what to do next.
Well, you know, the thing is this. That we can't take another step until we find Mary.
Well, that's right. I think
it's
that's
a little too long now. I think she's missing. It's the case now for the authorities.
And it's very obvious that Pop can't play Mary's role, Violetta, whatever it is, in the show. It's just impossible. Won't work.
Well, I think you're right in that respect.
Yeah, you certainly are. I don't want to play a lady's part anyway. I'd like to be the part of the old beggar, I think. Something like I did in Tale of Two Cities.
Yeah, that was a good... You were terrific. I remember you were critically acclaimed for your portrayal of the beggar.
Yes, I was. I don't know whether there's a part like that in La Traviata, though.
Well, maybe they could write one in. They do that in a lot of Broadway shows, you know. If a friend of the producer comes along and they say, oh, let's write her in. Let's find a nice little part for her.
Yes, right.
Maybe they could do that in La Traviata.
Yeah, that might be.
It's showbiz. Look at here. I mean, it's all who you know and things like that. The whole world spins on clout.
Right.
Sure.
Well,
absolutely.
We've still got to think of how we're going to find Mary. Who can we turn to, Greg?
Well, I'd call a... Oh, you're talking to Greg, aren't you?
Well,
I was thinking, of course, we could call the police, but we have this language barrier. I just can't make myself understood to a cab driver, never mind an investigatory police officer.
A what?
Investigatory police officer.
Is that Italian, Mr. Barlow?
That's about as much Italian as I can say.
Investigatory?
Yes.
Investigatory.
I can say fettuccine, which is quite Italian, I've been told. Or, that's a good one, Cavatelli.
La Scala.
Uh-huh. Yeah, La Scala. Rigatoni is Italian, isn't it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But those are all pastas. I mean, you can't call up the police and rattle off a list of pastas to the police officer.
Now, I wonder if we called a travel agent. They must be able to speak English, so...
Where do you want to go?
Well, I don't want to go anywhere, but they might be able to help us find Mary.
Well, I never heard a call to travel agency to find somebody who was busy.
Well, that's kind of locking the barn door after the horse is stolen.
That's the funniest thing I've heard all day. That's a riot.
What do you mean, locking the barn door after the horse is stolen?
Well, it's kind of like a deja vu thing.
Well,
you know.
No, it's nothing to do with deja vu. It's just that it's too late to do anything about the horse after he's been stolen. You might as well lock the barn door then.
Listen, I have a thought. I think this might be the thing for us to do.
What's that, Greg?
What we should do is go to the American Embassy and explain our situation to them, and they could place us in the direct, or could tell us who to see.
Well, are you sure they speak English there?
Where?
At the American Embassy.
Are you kidding, Harry?
And so, our friends hit upon the idea of contacting the American Embassy in Milan. Will they be able to help them find Mary? Join us tomorrow when we'll hear Greg Marlowe say...
Yes, and she's been missing now several days.
That's tomorrow in the next exciting episode of Mary Backstage Noble Wife. Word Carr speaking.
Well, it's a pleasure to welcome the producer, writer, creator of Mary Backstage, Chester Hasbrook Frisbee. I haven't seen you for a long time, Chet.
Well, we've been busy trying to get some background for our Italian trip.
Did you see in the paper...
Having a little difficulty finding, no.
In the paper yesterday that the real La Scala Opera Company has had to cancel its tour to this country because of financial problems in Italy.
Oh, I see some of your listeners are attributing it to your backstage episodes.
Yeah, I don't know. How do you feel about it?
I don't think that's fair. I don't think we had anything to do with it. I really don't.
It is kind of a far-fetched storyline to have Mary and Harry singing opera, which they've never done before in Italy.
Well, the problem I'm running into, excuse me, is finding actors who speak Italian.
Well,
and that is developing into a major problem.
None of the regulars do, huh?
I'm thinking now of flying the backstages back to New York tonight.
Oh, well, it's...
I mean, if I just can't find an actor who can speak Italian.
Well, when will that happen in regard to the show itself? I mean, they've done the episode for the day, right?
I'd have them out of there tomorrow if I
they're
can.
Not really there, right?
Of course they're not there.
Well...
But if I can't find an actor who speaks Italian... neither you nor your partner do that.
No.
It's a problem that the writer has to face each day.
It's almost time for you to be casting off that great coat that's a symbol of you, isn't it?
Well, not yet.
It's 4:30.
Yes, sir.
Lester Smith is waiting with the news, and then we'll be back here at Bob and Radio New York over WOR, the talk of New York. Welcome now to another episode of Wing Po, the true-to-life story of a Chinese philosopher who wanders across the American frontier in search of work. As our breathtaking drama begins today, Wing Po has just entered the camp of a notorious bounty hunter. The man approaches and eyes our hero with suspicion.
What are you up to, fella? I don't want to see any man around here unless he's got a price on his head.
I would be most happy to accommodate you by putting a price on mine, but I'm uncertain of its value. However, my head is filled with wisdom and should be quoted higher on the resale market than most.
I got a hunch you don't even know what I'm talking about. Now, clear out of here, will you?
Of course. I'm most sorry to have imposed my person upon your person. It's only that I seek honest work and often must be brazen in my attempts to obtain it.
Well, if you're looking for a job, you sure came to the wrong place. Why would a bounty hunter need an assistant?
Oh, I am sure I could learn most quickly to help you hunt for bounties. You need only tell me what one looks like, and I will search for them diligently.
Well, dad drat it, fella, you don't go around hunting for the bounties. You hunt for wanted criminals, and then you take them in so you can collect the reward money. Here, have a look at these wanted posters here. Let me know if you've seen any of these characters.
Oh, sadly, these pictures show the men only as they appear on the outside. As a philosopher, I search always for the inner person. And this I do for the Roro price of just $6 per month, plus room and board, also carfare.
Well, your price is sure cheap enough, and I reckon maybe I could use a helper at that. So, consider yourself hired.
Your decision shows great wisdom, and I also throw in flute concerts at no extra charge.
Obadiah, why are you wasting your time talking to this joker? You know, there's never been a picture of a man on a wanted poster wearing an evening dress.
My garment is known as kimono, and there's a fascinating story I might recount concerning the embroidered dragon on the back.
Look, before you go into any long stories, I think Martha ought to understand that you're my new assistant. Martha, this fellow's going to search for the insides of wanted men while I hunt for their outsides.
In a manner of speaking, this is true, for one must seek the inner person.
Obadiah.
Before...
Did I just hear you say that this clown hunts for people's insides?
Perhaps I should explain. One must always find inner...
Better let me do the explaining, fellow. Martha's got kind of a closed mind when it comes to accepting new ideas. You see, Martha, this new man's a philosopher. Naturally, he goes around looking at people's insides the way you and me look at their outsides. And we only got to pay him $6 a month to do it.
True, for my needs are simple, and...
Well, I don't care how much you pay him. Bounty hunters have a bad enough reputation without letting us hire this weirdo to do whatever he has in mind.
Perhaps you would better understand my mission in life if I were to relate the parable of the water buffalo and the dying lotus tree.
One more word out of you, and I'll chase you out of the territory with a meat cleaver.
No, please. I do not wish to have the tranquility of my being disturbed. Notice, if you will, I have already begun to depart, for fate has destined that I do so. Goodbye. And so our hero moves off down the trail to his next thrilling adventure. Be sure to join us next time for more incredible excitement in the life of Wing Po.
Fishing's not the reason I don't want to go to school. Swimming holes don't bother me, cause I'm no swimming fool. Teacher thinks I'm stupid, but I know that she's wrong. Cause if she taught me my way, it wouldn't take me long. I could learn my ABCs, bring home A's instead of D's, and my mom and dad I'd please if I had rhythm in my nursery rhyme. Rhythm in my nursery rhyme. In the corner on the stool I'd sit cause I broke a rule, but I'd show them I'm no fool if I had rhythm in my nursery rhyme. Hey, rhythm in my nursery rhyme. Tra-la-la-la-la won't get me far. Lately I've been thinking, if I had a little bit of rhythm, I could be a Washington or a Lincoln. Temple Simon at the fair met the fireman who was there, but those two guys I don't care. Rhythm in my nursery rhyme. Jack and Jill went up the hill. They were on a social climb, but they don't give me a thrill, 'cause I need rhythm in my nursery rhyme. I need rhythm in my nursery rhyme. Mary and little lamb, they both had such good times, but I told them both to scram. Rhythm in my nursery rhyme. Rhythm in my nursery rhyme. And I've got a use for Mother Goose, she don't mean a thing. I'm in favor of old King Cole, he made his fiddler swing. Lullabies are all okay when my mama does them her own way, but to go for that dit rhythm in my nursery rhyme, rhythm in my nursery rhyme, rhythm in my nursery rhyme.
Pita, Pita, Dean, and Rhythm in My Nursery Rhymes. And here at exactly 5:10, what say we have a check on the traffic? Fred?
What say? Why not? Okay, any advertising agencies that may have wanted to shoot a commercial over New York waiting for a nice day, if you didn't do it today, you blew it. It's got to be one of the 10 best. Getting downstairs, the Harlem River Drive in pretty good shape in both directions. Willis Avenue Bridge traffic a bit slow now, getting up into the Bronx, the problem. About 3 minutes ago, we did have a stalled car in the left lane just before you make your left turn to the Deegan. So coming over the Willis Avenue Bridge, prepare to switch them just a bit to the right, getting into the Bronx. Elevated Bruckner Expressway, again, is quite heavy getting up into Hunts Point, but there were all lanes were open. Cross Bronx, it does appear as though we might have a tie-up for the troops starting away from the George Washington Bridge, going eastbound over toward the Throgs Neck. There seemed to be a stall, something or other, in the right lane in that big underpass underneath Grand Concourse. That's about the second or third one as you start eastbound. Be prepared to merge to your left. It's not causing any great backup yet. Major Deegan is good, but it is pretty slow going up the ramp to the George Washington Bridge. The bridge itself and the immediate area is good. West Side Highway, Goodall. Down at the Lincoln Tunnel, very heavy traffic getting out of town, as is about normal for this time. So far, Abe is good coming into New York as we go back to Bob and Ray.
This is Ray.
And now it's time once again to pick up more valuable hints for all you home handymen as we pay another of our regular visits to the basement workshop of Fred Falvey, the do-it-yourselfer. Say, Fred, I noticed that you have a lot of those tan threads stretched across the wall of the shop today. Are you using that in one of your current projects?
Well, actually, that is the project, Ray. The wife was planning to throw out some old nylon stockings, and I realized that I could make some fine fishing line just by unraveling the thread with a few simple tools. Now I've got it stretched along the wall to straighten out those little curlicues that result from weaving thread into stockings.
Well, it's certainly a worthwhile project, sir. It must have involved an awful lot of work, though.
Well, it is a little painstaking, Ray. You have to pull out each loop in the weaving with a pair of number 9 tweezers. But just working on it every evening for about a week, I've converted the stockings into 3/4 of a mile of good nylon fishing line.
3/4 of a mile. Gee, that should be enough to give any fish a lot of play.
Yes, especially since you can only go after minnows and very small perch with such a lightweight line. Those varieties don't put up much of a fight, so giving them a run of 3/4 of a mile should be plenty.
Very true. And so once again, friends of the radio audience, we behold a typical example of better living by doing it yourself. And Fred, I know the home handymen listening in are all anxious now to hear about the workshop project that you plan to describe for them today.
Well, this week, Ray, I've chosen a very timely workshop project to describe to the home handymen listening in. As you know, we're moving into that time of the year when the common cold becomes even more common. But very few do-it-yourselfers realize that they can protect themselves by making vitamin C tablets right in the basement workshop.
Well, I've heard that vitamin C is supposed to ward off colds, but I never realized that you could make it in the basement workshop.
Well, don't feel foolish about it, Ray. Actually, very few do-it-yourselfers realize that they can protect themselves by making vitamin C right in the basement workshop. However, it's really quite simple, just using a few simple tools like this microwave oven I have here.
I see, and
What about those little brown marbles there next to the oven?
Those aren't brown marbles, Ray. They're oranges that I've baked in the oven at a very high temperature for about 6 hours.
Oh.
It takes that long to get all the moisture out of them.
Well, that's a valuable tip for our fond listeners to remember, assuming it has something to do with making vitamin C.
Oh, yes, that's a very important part of the project. See, all citrus fruit is rich in vitamin C, but the tablets we want to make don't stick together if the oranges we're using are still damp inside, so they must be dehydrated completely.
Well, can't you just swallow all those little brown things to ward off colds?
No. Those are just dehydrated oranges at this point. They're still full of seeds and all that, so they have to be put through an ordinary No. 5 household grinder that produces this very fine tin powder that you see over here.
But how can you convert that powder into vitamin C tablets?
No trick at all for a home handyman, Ray. You just pour the powder into any type of small mold and then compress the mold tightly in a No. 8 vise until tablets like these are formed.
Gee, those look more like toy soldiers than vitamin pills, Fred.
Well, it's because the only mold I had available is one my little boy uses to make lead soldiers. But the shape of the tablet isn't important, and by using what I had on hand, I avoided the cost of buying a special mold for pills from a pharmaceutical house.
Well, I can see how that would be a big money saver, Fred. And by cutting corners that way, I'm sure you can make your own vitamin C tablets for a lot less than they'd cost at the drugstore.
Well, I haven't priced them at the drugstore, but I'm sure that's true. Only expense I had was for the oranges, so my total cost for 30 vitamin tablets has been less than $45.
I see. And, of course, the best part is that you know that they're fresh and haven't lost their potency sitting on a dealer's shelf.
That's true.
So, once again, we've witnessed a truly spectacular example of better living by doing it yourself. Direct from the basement workshop of Fred Falvey, the do-it-yourselfer.
Now more Bob and more Ray and more Radio New York over more WOR New York.
Greetings and the warmest of welcome to you sports fans. This is Biff Burns emanating from Mike's side here in the Biff Burns Sports Room. And I'm going to be talking with a noted sports figure who's here with us today, Walter K. Lubling, the coach of the Olympic basketball team from Hadley Island. Walt, to open the interview with the most penetrating question, where is Hadley Island?
It's in the South Pacific, Biff. It's one of those little coral reefs between Hawaii and Australia where happy Polynesians hang out, and even the men wear long skirts and like that.
Well, Walt, I can't help making the observation that you're wearing an inexpensive business suit yourself, and you wouldn't appear to be of Polynesian extraction even if you had on a skirt. So what's the scoop there?
Well, Biff, I'd say the scoop there is that I'm not a Polynesian, and I've only lived on Hadley Island for about 2 months. That's when I answered an ad in the St. Paul Pioneer Press for a guy to go down there and coach their Olympic team.
Well, Walter, I'm inclined to gather from your most recent utterance that this leads us to a veritable story behind a story. A small island which has never before sent a team to the Olympics runs an ad in an American newspaper for a team coach, and quite obviously you answered that ad. Now, what's the story behind the story there, Walt?
Well, Biff, the story behind the story is that Hadley Island is a little country that never sent a team to the Olympics before, so they decided to run an ad in an American newspaper to get a coach, and obviously I answer the ad.
Uh-huh.
I guess that's the story behind the story.
Well, you put it quite succinctly, Walt. As I mentioned earlier, you're only the Olympic coach for basketball on Hadley Island. Is someone else handling the tutelage of other events?
No, basketball's the only event they're entering in the Olympics, Biff. I looked over the talent down there, and first thing that came to my attention was the fact that there are only 5 men who live on Hadley Island.
I see. And, of course, having 5 athletes to work with immediately made you think of forming a basketball team.
Well, no, not right away. First, I also had to notice that the average height of the 5 guys who live there is a little over 8 feet.
And, of course, having 5 men of such inordinately large stature immediately caused you to think of forming a basketball team.
Well, no, not right away. See, they never heard of basketball. So I asked them to show me some native sports they already knew, you know, how to play and everything. But all they knew how to do was to have contests to see who could stay under the water longest without drowning.
Uh-huh.
Also, they've got a game where they skip pebbles out under the surf. And then for real kicks, they hold a shell up to their ear and try to imitate the roaring noise it makes.
Well, of course, none of those native sports is on the Olympic agenda, so that immediately prompted you to form a basketball
team. That's right, but how did you guess? Have I told you this story before?
No, it simply seemed the logical conclusion to reach based on the input of data I've received from you, Walt. But that still doesn't explain why you're here in the States long before the Summer Olympics are due to begin in Montreal.
Well, I thought I'd better bring my guys over here while the basketball season is still going on in this country. That way they can watch some games and even play a few unofficial contests against American teams. Like I say, the people on Hadley Island had never heard of basketball before I got there.
Well, with their inordinately large stature...
Excuse me, but I don't think I mentioned that... They only have three native sports, seeing who can stay underwater the longest without drowning, skipping pebbles on the surf, and holding seashells up to their ears while they try to imitate the roar.
Actually, you had mentioned that at some length, Walt, but the more penetrating thought I was about to express dealt with the inordinately large stature of your athletes. Standing more than 8 feet tall should make them natural basketball stars. How they fared so far?
Well, not too good, Biff. We only played one exhibition game coming across the country, but my guys lost it to Buffalo Grove Township High School in Utah. The score was 116-4.
A team of eight-footers lost to a small rural high school 116-4. I find myself totally at a loss to comprehend such a turn of events.
Well, I'd find myself at a loss, too, if I hadn't seen it, Biff. My guys missed the whole first half by having a contest to see who could stay in the shower longest without drowning. And then they tried to skip the ball across the floor without bothering to catch it on the other side. And when they weren't doing that, they just hold the ball up to their ear and then try to imitate the noise it made. But, of course, basketball doesn't make any noise.
Well, now I can understand how such a defeat would be possible, but couldn't you explain to them that basketball isn't played like their native sports back home?
Oh, I can't explain anything to them, Biff. I can't speak a word of the language, so I just let them do whatever they want. After all, you know, you don't blow your stack at a bunch of guys 8 feet tall, especially when they don't seem to like you much anyway.
No, I'd say you acted wisely. Walt,
sure.
I want to thank you for stopping by and telling us your formula for getting along amicably with your team. And this is Biff Burns saying until next time, this is Biff Burns saying so long.
You'll find it in the food section of your local newspapers this week. A coupon for one free bar of Tone soap when you buy two bars at the regular price. It's our way of helping you experience the creamy skin softness that only Tone's cocoa butter can give. So clip the free coupon from the newspaper and redeem it at your store when you buy two bars of Tone, the moisturizing soap with cocoa butter.
Butter.
And now, through the courtesy of the Ashenfelder Whip Socket Company, we take you back to...
June 19th, 1776. Dudley Holgate writes the Declaration of Independence. Bob and Ray was there.
Excuse me, Mr. Holgate. My name's Herbie. I'm from the Continental Congress Secretarial Pool. They said you asked for a stenographer to be sent up here to your office.
Oh, yes, of course. Sit down anywhere with your quill and paper. See, the Congress asked me to draw up a Declaration of Independence, but my handwriting is so illegible that I told them I'd need a stenographer to take dictation.
Well, I'm your man, Mr. Holgate. I can put all those fancy little swirls that really make a document look classy.
Oh, good.
But if you'll excuse my impertinence, how come they picked you to write the Declaration of Independence? You're not even a delegate to Congress.
I know, but Ben and George and some of the others liked the phrasing I gave them off the top of my head at lunch the other day, so they said they'd give me a whirl at writing the document.
Well, it's really an honor to get to write the Declaration of Independence, Mr. Holgate. I even feel like I'm becoming a part of history myself. So just start dictating whenever you're ready, sir.
Well, very well, Herbie. Take this down. When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another... and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station.
Oh, just a second, sir. You're getting a little ahead of me there. When? In?
Great Scott, Herbie. Are you still back at the very beginning?
Yeah, but I assume you want this written real neat and flowery, Mr. Holgate. I mean, they'll probably frame it and hang it up someplace.
so you don't want blotchy ink marks and things all over it.
Well, that's true enough, but at this rate, it might take us days to finish the whole thing. Can you go just a little faster?
Well, certainly not, sir. I take pride in my work. Of course, if you're really anxious to get it done, I suppose you could, cut out some of that long-winded language you were just feeding me.
Well, what's long-winded about when in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve?
Are you kidding? Why can't you just say we're breaking off from you guys and becoming separate? I guess the idea across.
Yes, I suppose maybe you're right. So just get that down and then continue with this. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they're endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights.
Wait a minute. Wait just 1 minute. You don't need all that, Holgate. Just say, we're as good as you are.
Well, that's not really the kind of awe-inspiring rhetoric I had in mind for this document. You sure that's enough?
Certainly. Have I ever given you a bum steer before?
No, I suppose not. So would you read back what you've got so far?
All right. It says, we're breaking off from you guys and becoming separate on account of we're as good as you are. Well, that's it. You want to find out anything else, are you?
Well, yes, I do have quite a few other points I want to touch upon.
Look, take my advice, pal. Don't do it. You got to always leave them wanting more. You know, that's the secret of this historical document business. Besides, my penmanship on what you've got so far is real scrolly and, you know, artsy. Now, that'll sell the whole decoration just on beauty alone. So relax, Holgate. With my help, you've just written one of the great documents of history.
Well, your confidence makes me feel a great deal better, Herbie. They were planning to give this job to Thomas Jefferson, but I convinced them I could handle it. Now, if you'll excuse me, I'm going to lie down for a while, safe in the knowledge that the name of Dudley Holgate has found a spot in American history.
And so it was that Dudley Holgate allowed a brash, persuasive young stenographer to rewrite the document that could have made him famous. Instead, Holgate's version of the Declaration of Independence was unanimously rejected by the Continental Congress, and Thomas Jefferson was commissioned to write the same words that Holgate had originally wanted to put on paper. Meantime, Holgate lived out his life as an obscure buttonhook maker, having missed his chance for greatness on a warm summer day. And what sort of a day was it? A day like all days that alter and illuminate our times. The date?
June 19th, 1776. Dudley Holgate writes the Declaration of Independence. Bob and Ray was there.
Now here's the headline from the WOR newsroom. City Hall sources say New York City will have to cut 6,000 more municipal jobs. Roger Skibinus will have details on that and all the news in 8 minutes at 6 o'clock.
And welcome now to Widen Your Horizons, part of our show where we help you acquire new skills for leading a fuller, happier life. Our subject today should be of interest to every adult who's ever contemplated going into a store and trying to buy something. We're going to learn how to make change. And our guest lecturer is Mr. Warner D. Bogash. Mr. Bogash, I assume it's the United States Mint that sends you out to teach Americans how to tell one denomination coin from another.
No, I work for the Interstate Metal Products Company. We make those coin changes like streetcar motormen wear on their belts.
Uh-huh.
But our sales have been slumping for about 40 years now, and Mr. Bascom assumes it's because fewer of our young people know how to make change.
Well, has Mr. Bascom ever considered the possibility that your sales may be down because there are very few streetcar motormen left?
No, I don't think he's ever considered that possibility.
All right, I was just curious about that, even though I don't know, Mr. Bascom. In any event, you seem convinced in your own mind that very few Americans know how to make change.
I don't think there's any doubt about it. We can see evidence of stupidity in that field all around us. For example, you take public telephones, where the operator is always telling you to deposit 10 cents. Mm-hmm. Obviously, people don't know how to do that and are depositing much larger amounts. How else could you explain the net profit of AT&T rising from $2.25 billion in 1971 to more than $3 billion last year?
Well, I guess the only explanation is the failure of the public to realize that 10 cents is only a dime, so I think you'd better move right along to your lecture. We've obtained several different denominations of coins from the bank, as you requested, and they're right here on the desk.
Oh, yes, thank you. I used to carry my own coins to the lectures, but then I got a hole in my pocket and my pants, and that did that.
I guess that's an occupational hazard.
They carry a lot of change.
Sure.
It's really about a half inch across, so the money drops right out the bottom.
Uh-huh.
This stuff you got from the bank is the same type of American money I would have brought along if I'd brought some.
Okay.
And I want to point out first that one of the denominations is sort of a maroon color, while the others are all silver. The maroon one is the smallest coin. It's called the penny.
Well, it's not really maroon, Mr. Bogash. Do you think our listeners would be more apt to know what you're talking about if you call it copper color?
No, because I have it here in my lecture manual that the maroon one is worth the penny. And if you start changing the name of the color to me, or on me, then I won't know where I am, you see.
Okay, well, then call it whatever you want.
Thank you. I'll call it maroon. Now, among the ones that are silver-colored, the biggest confusion arises over making change that involves the nickel here and the dime over here.
And I suppose that confusion exists because the nickel is larger than the dime, but actually worth less.
No, quite the contrary. A dime is smaller than a nickel, but it's actually worth more. Then this one over here is a quarter. So what the beginner has to remember is that five pennies make a nickel, five nickels make a quarter, and a dime comes between a nickel and a quarter. But it never comes out even.
Well, a dime is worth two nickels, isn't it?
No, I don't think so. But then, as I remarked earlier, the nickel is a problem coin because it's bigger than a dime. But actually, it's worth
less.
Well,
let's not reopen that subject. Just go ahead and continue.
Well, that's about all there is to it. So you can take your coins back now and also this big medallion here on the desk.
Well, that's not a medallion, Mr. Bogash. It's a half dollar. I thought you might want to use it in the lecture.
No, I only use real coins to demonstrate with. I never saw one of those things before. What'd you say it's called, a half dollar?
Half dollar, right. Mr. Bogash, how long have you been conducting these lectures on making change?
Oh, about a week now. I just moved here from a small island out in the South Pacific, where we conduct all our business by bartering seashells and coconuts. So I was real interested to see that you people had coins. And Mr. Bascom thought that conducting these lectures would help me learn about them faster. But I guess it hasn't worked out that way. So, goodbye.
Goodbye. You've been listening to an informative lecture by Mr. Warner D. Bogash on the subject of how to make change. Join us soon when you'll have a chance to learn another valuable new skill on our next edition of Widen Your Horizon.
Editor for the News at 6, Walter Troy Spencer. Roger Skibben is reporting for Lyle Vann. Our next news at 6:30 with Lester Smith. Back we go to Bob and Ray.
As you may know, one of the public services we occasionally perform here at the Bob and Ray Show is satisfying your curiosity about the little one- and two-paragraph feature stories that appear from time to time in the newspapers.
Papers run those every day, but they never seem to follow up on them to let us know how the stories came out. So every once in a while, we track down some of the people whose stories have appeared and bring them here to New York so they can tell us how they did work their stories out. And our first guest was the subject of a United Press feature some months ago, and you're Mr. Hubert Wedlow of Harrisburg, Illinois. Is that right, sir?
Yes, that's correct. I became involved in one of those humorous foul-ups that computers are always making.
Yes.
And, of course, the newspapers love to print feature items about that subject.
Mm-hmm.
I understand I got almost 2 full inches of space in more than 400 papers from coast to coast.
That's more publicity than most of us achieve in a lifetime, Mr.
Yes.
Wedlow. I understand the computer mistake in your case was made on your weekly paycheck.
Yes, I work for the gas company back home, and I'm supposed to make $162 a week.
Right.
But then one week the machine went haywire and issued me a check for $10,162,000. Of course, I knew right away it was a mistake.
Sure.
And I couldn't keep the money. But I showed the check to the local newspaper before I gave it back. And, the editor made quite a fascinating item out of it.
Yep, well, I'm sure a lot of our listeners saw that original item, but then we never heard how the story came out. Were you rewarded for promoted for your honesty in giving back that $10 million check?
No, I was fired the next week.
Uh-huh.
You see, the boss's wife is in charge of the payroll department. And the boss thought I should have come to him quietly instead of pointing out coast to coast how his missus was a dimwit for not catching a mistake like that.
Well, it's obvious from your shabby appearance you haven't been able to find another job, but we do thank you for coming clear to New York to tell us the sad conclusion of your story, sir.
Sure.
Now, let's see. Another feature story follow-up is here in the person of Mrs. Clara Shumbaugh of Moberly, Missouri. I understand the Associated Press ran a picture as well as a feature story about you, Ms. Shumbaugh.
Yes, they had a photographer right on the scene at the Missouri State Fair when I won a blue ribbon for my giant cucumber. It was almost 2 feet long, and it weighed more than 19 and a half pounds.
I remember seeing the picture in the paper. The cucumber really was enormous. But I'm wondering what happened after the original story appeared. Did you sign contracts to display the giant cucumber at other fairs?
No. In fact, the newspapers had barely hit the streets when we cut the thing open and found it wasn't a cucumber. It was a watermelon with bumps on the outside. I can't imagine how it got mixed in with my cucumber display, and, well, I felt awfully silly about the whole thing.
Well, I can see how you would, but you're a good sport to come here and tell us about it anyway. And now with today's last feature story follow-up, here is Mr. Herbert Botchford of Cleveland, Ohio. Mr. Botchford, I understand the item about you appeared in almost 900 newspapers.
Yes, it was in the Cleveland Plain Dealer originally, but then it was picked up by one of the national news services, and I heard later it was also carried throughout the British Commonwealth by Reuters.
That's an amazing coverage. What was your story that attracted so much attention?
Well, I went out to my mailbox one day last April, and I thought it was kind of funny that one of the letters had real old Christmas seals on it. But then I also noticed that there was just a 2-cent stamp on the front. So I examined the postmark very carefully.
Yes, I know you did, to make a long story short.
Well, I don't usually make it short when I'm telling it.
I know, but we're running out of time. What it all boils down to is you received a letter that had taken 47 years to be delivered, even though it was mailed right in the same city.
That's right. It was mailed in 1928. The post office people can't figure what happened to it all those years, but it finally turned up and got delivered.
Well, it's a mystery may never be solved, but one thing you could clear up for us, sir, the news story didn't mention who that long-lost letter was from.
It was from the Internal Revenue Service, telling me that I owed another $10 on my 1927 income tax.
Well, I'm sure that small debt was canceled after you explained what happened.
No, you see, figuring compound interest for all those years, I now owe $9,433.67, and I can't pay it. So I'll be starting my prison term next week.
Well, then I'm glad we caught up with you while you're
yes.
still available. I want to thank you and all of the other guests for stopping by today so we could learn how your feature stories came out.
And Wally Ballew has just signaled that he's standing by with a report now on the formal opening of New York's newest tunnel. Frankly, I didn't know that we had a new tunnel. But anyway, come in, please, Wally Ballew.
Wally Ballew speaking from Garden City, Long Island, where the Grubmeister Tunnel is going to be open to traffic in just a very few minutes. With me is the man responsible for this engineering feat, Mr. Franklin Grubmeister. And as I understand it, sir, this tunnel begins here in Garden City, runs under part of Long Island, the East River, all of Manhattan Island, the Hudson River, and then comes up in Teaneck, New Jersey.
That's correct, Mr. Ballew. This tunnel is about 20 miles long, and I'm proud to say that I dug every bit of it myself. Here's the shovel I used right here.
You mean you dug a 20-mile tunnel with a shovel?
That's right. I started at my home at Teaneck in 1957, and I came up here in Garden City last Tuesday morning about 10:15.
Well, what in the world prompted you to undertake such a project as this?
Well, I live in Teaneck, and I work in Manhattan.
Uh-huh.
And, boy, oh, boy, you know, driving in during rush hour every day really get under my skin. Now, you wait in line at the tunnel entrance for maybe 15 minutes, a half hour.
Uh-huh.
Time just wasted. So I decided I'd build my own tunnel and whiz back and forth whenever I wanted to.
You said you work in Manhattan. Why did you build the tunnel to Garden City, Long Island?
Well, I didn't have any professional engineering help on this job, and so I just guessed at where my office was. And when I came up, I found it, I'd overshot it by a few miles. But it still makes a lot better time than I would if I used the public tunnel.
Well, look at the long line of cars backed up at the entrance to the tunnel here, Mr. Grubmeister. I never saw a traffic jam worse than this at the Lincoln or the Holland tunnels.
Well, this is different. I own the tunnel. I go in whenever I want to. I have my car parked over to one side, and I have a special ramp I use. Here, I'll show you.
Oh, yes, it's a ramp off to the side that enables you to bypass this long string of cars.
Hey, what do you think you're doing, white guy? Get to the end of the line, buddy.
That man in the blue convertible there is yelling at you, Mr. Grubmeister. I guess he doesn't know you own the tunnel.
It's all right, fella. I own the tunnel.
He's getting out of his car, and he's coming this way now, and he looks like he has a tire iron in his hand.
Yeah, I guess maybe I'd better go back and get at the end of the line.
That would be my advice. Looks from here as if the line is about a mile long.
Yeah, I'd better get back there before it gets any longer.
Well, I want to thank you for chatting with us. And this is Wally Ballew in Garden City, Long Island.
Oh, try your friends.
Sending it back to Bob Ray in New York.
Hi, this this is Orson Bean for your postal service. I just bought my godmother Abigail one of those, whoops, sorry I missed your birthday cards. Actually, it's the second card I'm sending her this week. See, the first one would have gotten there in time, only I botched up her address. So it came back stamped, addressee unknown, return to sender. I accidentally wrote in my friend Abner's address instead of my godmother Abigail's. It's a good thing I didn't botch up my return address. Actually, the post office says over 10 million pieces of mail are misaddressed every day. Sometimes they can piece the clues together and deliver it anyway. Only chances are it's going to be delayed. In fact, all that extra mail going back and forth slows things up for everybody. So this time around, I'm going to be a little more careful. I'll write in Godmother Abigail's complete name and address, nice and neat, include the zip, and of course I'll put down my return address again. There, perfect. Now, when a letter's addressed like that, it helps the Postal Service work better for everybody.
Okay, Stan, thank you very much. We'll see you tomorrow, and I guess everybody else can excuse themselves now. It's all over for Bob and Ray.
Yeah, but hang around for the WOR Mystery Theater. It follows the Fort Lewis News commentary coming up in a few seconds, and tonight it's called The Covered Bridge.
Okay, see you tomorrow at 4:15. Until then, this is Ray Goulding reminding you to write if you get work.
Bob Elliott reminding you to hang by your thumbs.
And this is WOR New York, an RKO general station.